Hey everybody, I'm Dave, I'm an alcoholic. Hey Dave. And as I always say, it is really a privilege to present to you guys, but really to do it in this room, which is so important to me, is means a lot. We are on There Is a Solution. We finished Bill's story, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now, and so chapter two is There Is a Solution. We'll jump right into it just so I can do better with time. So it says, I'll get stuck immediately. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill, and nearly all have recovered. But my question is, and I'm supposed to be the guy with the answers, how can there be thousands of men and women when the book was written by 100 people? Right? I tried to look that up and see how takes me years and years and years of reading the same thing over and over again to, you know, to, but anyway. I'm sure there's a good answer. I just don't have it. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. So again, the theme of my presenting the book is the book has just been published. It's 1939, and there's no Alcoholics Anonymous. You are receiving this book and reading it by yourself and trying to overcome something you totally don't understand. You know, we're so lucky to have AA and to some respect, these detoxes and rehabs and IOPs and Passages Malibu and all the other things that we get to have as a potential answer to our problem. Back then, when this book was written, they didn't have any of that. There was no AA, and that's a hard thing to really reconcile, and I'll try to point that out as we go along. It says, we are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented. So he's trying to give you a description of what you're getting into. As well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. And that's true, right? I mean, the friendships we make here are so wonderful, indescribably wonderful. I'm friends with people who I would never, ever, and have been friends with people who we would not mix. And, you know, I like to say when I speak, usually in rehabs and detoxes, one of the most important things for us to understand or for me to understand is when we're in recovery and we're in AA, we're not, you know, man and woman, old and young, you know, black or white, Christian or Jew. We are all alcoholics. We are all exactly the same, exactly. And that's the beauty of it. We're here for one reason. We're all the same. We all have the same problem, and we're all here to help each other get better. And that is. I didn't understand that for a while. I always thought, and I don't think I'm the only one, but I will speak for myself. I thought I was a little special when I got here, you know. I thought I was a little different than you guys, you know. And you see it, you know. You see it. Some people have more money. Some get the good-looking girls. You have the working-class heroes. You all various descriptions of people who think my story is a little different. And that kept me sick. I'm sure there's a better word, but for a long time, thinking I was different, you know, and that's a gift of it. We are all the same, you know, and you know, I love everybody in here, and it just was not always that way. It says here, there exists among us a fellowship of friendliness and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful, and that's what I was just talking about. We're like passengers on the great liner, the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to the captain's table. And this came out shortly after the Titanic. That's what they're trying to refer to. It says, unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having a shared have been shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. And that is true. That is true. That's true, you know, everywhere you go. We go down the shore. We spend a lot of time down the shore in the summer. We go to a meeting every morning there. And then when I go around the town with my family, you go to the ice cream place, you know somebody behind the counter. You go to the surf shop, you know somebody, you know, and your people are, how do you know all these people? How do you know all these people? And it's, you have, that's the one thing. I'm in a financial planning, whatever you want to call it. I have clients who I have worked with for 20 years and watched them retire, you know. And they'll go to Florida, and I've seen some come back because they can't make friends, you know. We can make friends wherever we go. You know, we go down there, we go to meetings, we got instant community, you know. Mm-hmm. And that really is a gift. That really is, because these people come back saying they can't make friends, you know. We can make friends wherever we go, which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. So when they say we, it's 100 people finding that wrote this book jointly or contributed to it. 100 people have discovered a common solution. And if you've ever been to an AA business meeting, that's pretty amazing. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree. We have a way out. We were at the Way Out group last night, on which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Just quickly, I mean, we were at a group last night. Anybody here go to Cheers? Go to the Way Out group, right? Okay, you guys were there last night, right? We had an incident last night where we thought one of our good friends had relapsed, and I got to say, the way everyone responded in helping, and it turns out he didn't, but he was taking some sort of vitamins or something that makes you look weird. Or you're trying to get muscles, but if you're not getting the muscles, you look like you're high on dope. I don't know. These kids today. But just it was wonderful all night. My phone's ringing, and everybody is so concerned. And it's just not like that outside this world. You know, it's just not like that. And I couldn't have been more proud of, and just more proud, just proud to be part of it, you know. And anyway, it worked out just fine. Except the guy's not here right now, which is a little, Anyway, and this is something, it's a little touchy. It says, an illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it is an illness, evolves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. And I love this. It says, if a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes alienation of all the things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. And that's always been something that's amazed me, and I'm a firm believer that we have cancer and we have alcoholism, and both of them kill us, especially back then, you know. And what we are willing to endure to overcome cancer, what we're willing to subject ourselves to get an extra 2 years out of life, and what I know I resisted to save my life from drugs and alcohol, it's crazy. You know, we're we're very lucky, and I think I know I took it for granted, and I think that's a great analogy when you compare the two. And anyone can increase the list. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who may be affected. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. The other thing is, too, back then, you know, when there's no AA, at least now people can say you need to go to Passages Malibu or, Happy Hills or someplace like that. You know, back then, they had not. They just, what's wrong with you? You drink too much. You need to grow up. You need to have more willpower. You need to. They didn't understand what the problem was back then. But, you know, here it says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, and I love this line, who is properly armed with the facts about himself can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And I love the where it says... who is properly armed with the facts about himself. And I think that's what we learn as we go through the step process. We learn, you know, what our problem is, and we learn things about ourselves. But, you know, we learn about alcoholism, you know. I thought this was entirely a drinking problem, and that's the least of my – well, there's a lot of other problems other than drinking. In our behaviors, our beliefs, our priorities. It says, the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty that he obviously knows... he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at his new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. And I have a little trouble with that, truth be told. And I'm getting better. But, I here's a good example. A guy called me the other day, or he texted me that he's coming to a meeting. Now, he hasn't been to a meeting in a month, and it's somehow it's some sort of treat for me that he's blessing us with his presence, you know. I'll be there. Hopefully, you'll be there. Blah blah blah. If the moons align, I'll be there, you know. And so he got there, and I was reading with somebody, but he said, you know, here, come, let's sit and talk. And he tells me all this wonderful stuff about his new job, and that's all great. But I said to him, I really like to get to use what the shots that were taken at me 20 years ago. I said, you know, Roy, you are doing the best imitation of somebody about to relapse I've seen in a long time, you know. And his face just, boom, you know. Wow. My sponsor had used that one on me, you know. And I didn't like it, and then that's lectures, you know, lectures. And mm-hmm. I just said, look, you were here to get a job, you know, and you got your job now, and you owe me a list, of resentments, you know, that I've been waiting for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's what I liked at the Way Out Group. There they have assignments. They use the word assignments, and I feel like I'm going easy on people. But I feel like I do firmly believe that we do need to try to tell people the truth from our experience. You know, I relapsed a lot, and I could see he's thinking the way I thought. You know, he's behaving the way I behaved, and he's going to get what I got. I just don't want him to get. We just don't want people to make the mistakes we made. I think as sponsors, and that's what this is about, sponsorship and mentorship, and we don't want you to make the mistakes we made. You know, you don't have to. If you listen, we're not good listeners. I sure wasn't. You know, I hope you guys are better. So there's no lectures to be endured after that little lecture. I gave the disclaimer. After such an approach is made, many take up their beds and walk again. It says here, none of us make a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that the elimination of our drinking is a beginning, and that is so true. That is so true. And, you know, again, if you're new, if you can get a sponsor who can explain to you why you're here, because I didn't know why I was here for a long time. And it's not, and ask the questions. You know, I can't blame it on anybody. I didn't want to know. I just wanted to get out as quick as I could and get better. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort which we are going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. Two things is, you know, we do this for free. It helps us. You know, we do it. Because it's, people did it for us. You know, it was done for us. We have to do it for others. And all I can tell you is it changes. You can't ask for a better life than a life of getting to be involved in the recovery of other people. You know, at least I've tried a lot of different lifestyles, and this is by far the most enjoyable, peaceful, serene. Content. There's another word I can't think of. But if we keep on the way we're going, there is little doubt that much good will result. But the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. And, you know, you could say that a little bit about AA, you know. You see, you know, I made the analogy here. Some guy pointed out we had been coming here 20-something years, and there was 10 of us still there. And he said, you know, if you take all the people who have come through this room and are not here today, we could fill Giant Stadium, you know. And there's some truth to that, you know. A lot of people come through. Hopefully they're doing okay. Many could recover if they have had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given to us? And that's an important line. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given to us? And I feel that takes never-ending work on how are you going to deliver the message. You know, how are you going to deliver the message of not drinking, but how are you going to deliver the message of... These are tricky messages to deliver, you know. Everyone's always, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys, and they're all... I'll try to say, you know, God is the answer, and they're going like this. They're just nodding their head to me, but I know inside they're going like this, you know. You know, like I was, you know. And I would rather have someone disagree with, you know. I almost appreciate belligerence, you know, because at least I know where we are, you know. But yeah, they're going like this, but I know inside. They you can tell in their eyes, you know. You can. Who said... you can tell within 15 seconds if someone's engaged, you know, if someone's, you know, anyway. Mm-hmm. How is this so freely given to us? We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we, the first 100 people see it. We shall bring to task our combined of the 100 people experience and knowledge. So that's an important thing. You're dealing with 100 different people who have different backgrounds but have all overcome drinking this specific way. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem. Of necessity, there will have to be a discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions or attitudes which make us more useful to others. So that's a tough one. You know, tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints. I'm getting better at it, but and I started at a very low bar. But I see a lot of groups around here that have a special way of delivering the message, and I understand what they're trying to achieve. You know, I was asked to go to one meeting because the leader made a guy cry. And now I hear he attacked a girl the other night. You know, it's a big book step meeting. And I understand what he's trying to achieve. You know, my point is there should be no contention or argument or, you know, in AA. I remember I went to a meeting. I shared this up in Summit that was a meeting 7 days a week. Open discussion, or is it? Yeah, I think it's open discussion, or maybe it's closed, whatever, closed discussion. But, you know, after 10 years of going to the same meeting, it didn't matter what the subject was. If you raised your hand on gratitude, I could just go word for word with what you were going to share. Anybody in the room, I was ready to blow my brains out, you know. And it's up to me to find a different meeting. But so I suggested we have a big book meeting. You know, I thought that would break it up. And it was really a controversial thing. It was a big vote, and people were fighting, and people stopped liking each other, and it was the craziest thing I ever saw. And it passed, and but I would never do that again. I would let people talk about whatever they, you know. I didn't like seeing people get upset with people. I didn't mind them getting upset with me. One guy said, one of the guys, pro, said, well, Dave Hall's a cancer to this meeting, you know. I take that as a badge of honor. But anyway, but yeah, I just don't think it's right. I don't think that's one of my shortcomings, and I don't think it's right for any contention. So this is a really important line. It says here, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So it doesn't say very important or pay attention, you know, or it says our very lives, you know, and that's true. That's true. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. And, you know, we don't come in here thinking of others, you know. And I was here a long time not thinking of others. And, you know, that's all we're here for. You know, it's funny, I just reference these groups that are a little kooky. But the point is, and I said it before, my experience is when you've had a spiritual awakening, it's so wonderful that you want everybody to have it. You want everyone else to have it. So you act a little kooky, you know, because you're like, you got to have it. You got to have it. You got to do, you got to have it, you know, because you know what you felt like before you had it. And you're so grateful somehow you got it. So, and it comes from thinking of others, you know, it comes from constant thought, self-sacrifice, it says later on. There's all sorts of great things. This book says like three things. And I mean, I always say it, trust God, you know, find God, do the steps, and help others, you know. And it just says the same three things over and over in different ways, just drilling them And it, you know, I wish I was paid more attention. You may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. And that's, you know, in 1939, that's groundbreaking information, mind and body. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? And that's a very blank question back then. Today, you can throw a stone and somebody will tell you, give you a pretty good idea of, you know, eight different options you have. But I do believe AA is the only long-term solution. It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we, the 100 people, have done. Before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. So this is effective for me. Nobody likes when I do it to them. Actually, I didn't like when it was done to me either. But how many times have people said, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't Dave? Why don't you drink? Why doesn't Dave drink like a gentleman or quit? Dave can't handle his liquor. Why doesn't Dave try beer and wine? Lay off the Jack Daniels. Dave's willpower is obviously weak. Dave could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, you'd think Dave would stop for her sake. And that's true. I mean, that's an important thing. I usually stop there when I'm reading is you know, I had a lot of nice people in my life when I was young. And I clearly chose alcohol and drugs over them, you know. And sometimes I was given a flat-out choice, and I would dance as much as I could. I would lie. Let's not kid it. You know, I would make up stories. But I look back, and I clearly, and these were, you know, we lose a lot. But anyway, you think Dave would stop for her sake, and the doctor told Dave that if he ever drank again, it would kill him, and there he is. All lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, and especially when there was no AA. You know, this is all we had to try to describe it. But in the back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. And it's not really, people mean well when they're saying that stuff to us. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. And I remember when my dad, really, who couldn't be a better guy, talking to me about my drinking. And he was a father who wanted to be my friend. He wasn't. My mom says that's why I'm an alcoholic, because your dad just wanted to be your friend. He wasn't a father to you. I was like, I don't think that's the reason, Mom, but whatever. But when he said, you can't not drink for a week. I don't believe you could ever stop for a week, and I did stop for a week. But then I went right to Dunn's Garage, where you got 2-for-1, and ordered 4 Long Island iced teas, and got 8, you know. And that's where it started. Then one time, Dan was taking a nap, and he was awoken by someone serving a warrant for a cocaine arrest. And that was the other time he was serious about my little issue. Anyway, ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. And God bless them. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. If they have good reason, they can take it or leave it alone. And these are pretty interesting distinctions. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, and that didn't. So I'm not in this category. Change of environment or warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need some medical attention. And I call these guys lubricators. You know, these are the guys who can have a six-pack every night, and they're okay. But what about, and this is a question we have to always ask ourselves and the people we meet, what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker, probably only because he can't get enough to drink. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. So that's obviously the qualifying question we ask when we work with somebody is, once you start, can you stop? And you want the answer to be, no, I can't. I can't. I need help, you know. A lot of people, though, want to try to soften the truth to that so that they don't sound too bad. You know, it's a, you really want to make sure the person is this last category. There's, you know, theories that AA has got a lot of people that may not be this category of alcoholic. I wouldn't argue with that, but it, you know, we're all here. So let's do the best we can. Here is a fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So Robert Louis Stevenson was a diehard alcoholic. He only lived till he was, I think he's 44 years old, Robert Louis Stevenson. And I read up on him. He idolized a guy named William Deacon Brody. They called him the Deacon. He was 100 years before in Scotland. And this guy was the ultimate gentleman by day, but by night he was a gambler, sex addict, and what else? Something else. He was that's the basis of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But eventually, in the end, Robert Louis Stevenson's he became the Deacon. He really cracked at the end, and he was a. So anyway, the point is, if you read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with the idea of alcoholism and what we become, it takes on a whole new meaning. And I did that, and you can really see it once you know about the author. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. And here they're just trying to describe to the reader, wherever he is reading this book, the various characteristics we take on as real alcoholics. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, and I thought they were talking about me. Yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight or drunk at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. And it talks about being antisocial. I was antisocial when I got here. You know, I was, again, I thought I was a little different. I was very, I was scared. You know, I was really scared. You know, so that's why, when the first week we were here, we talked about making the newcomer feel welcome, making them feel welcome. I hid behind thinking I was somehow different, but I was really just scared shitless. He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced, that's me again, concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish, and that is me. He often possesses special abilities, skills, aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then he pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. I do firmly believe that alcoholics are gifted people. I think we're all special people, gifted people. I've got to meet the kookiest of the kooky, and they are wonderful people. You know, I really think, and I've met a lot of non-alcoholics, and I, you know, maybe my view is warped, but I firmly believe that. I don't think if you go to Al-Anon, they'll agree, but I brought it up once at an Al-Anon meeting, and I was met with, luckily there were no guns in the
opposition.
Room. Yeah. But I do believe that. I really think we are gifted. We sell ourselves short, although I think some of us overthink we're gifted, but not, generally we don't. And that's the other thing we do is, I just met a guy at Pilgrim Group, and this guy's from Westfield, and he got so drunk he knocked down one of the lights up on Elm Street, you know, and this is like his fifth time. Those are big light poles. Yeah, he took one right out, you know, and it just made me. He's a successful guy, but he drinks too much, and you know, uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook, and then takes his car right through a light pole at Elm Street and Dudley. Anyway, he's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around, yet early the next morning he searches madly for a bottle he has misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he will have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets the entire supply from him to throw down the waste pipe. The best one I've ever heard is a guy who used to hide his big bottle of vodka in the sump pump. I thought that was a good spot. Right. And it's not supposed to excite you guys, you know. But that was a good one. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes the day he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Mm. Perhaps the doctor, perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him Vivitrol and Suboxone with which to taper off. And then he begins to appear in the detoxes and the rehabs. And that's the amazing thing. This is a soul sickness, right? I mean, we have a soul sickness. I believe is the best way to describe it, and it's a spiritual solution. And we learned, you know, back in 39, between 39 and 55, that it was a spiritual solution, that there was no need for medicine, and Silkworth writes it, you know, and everyone agrees. And then in 1955. And the recovery rate, 75%, from 39 to 55, roughly, you know, 50 to 75%. And in 55, the American Medical Association they say, you're right, we agree with you now. This is a disease. And we're going to designate alcoholism as a disease. And that's when the insurance companies got involved and the detoxes and rehabs. And I was involved in the... opioid discussion here in New Jersey with the Republican Assembly, and it's Chris S. told me, and he was right. He said, "We're going to hear them. They've got, you know, the Vivitrol people come in and they say, if we give you Vivitrol, you'll stay clean for 37.6 days, and we have evidence and studies to show that. If we give you a shot of Vivitrol, you'll stay clean for 37.6 days. And all the politicians are like, oh, wow, that's great. That's great. That's good. Good for you, Vivitrol people. And then the Suboxone people come in, and if we get you on Suboxone, we'll keep you clean for an average of 141 days and 6 hours. You know, you're kidding. 141 days, that's amazing. You're in, you know, you're in. We've got no proof. We've got no, you know, fact-based evidence, you know. And so, as Chris said, we don't have a seat at the table, you know. But I've never met anybody. I've never met anybody with good 10 years of sobriety who got it from Vivitrol, Suboxone, or an IOP, you know. So it's a dilemma. Anyway, get on these tangents for 12 weeks alone. Which taper off, he begins to appear at the detoxes and rehabs. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. But it is, this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him, and again, there's no AA here, so if you're the reader, you're like, yeah, I get this. If hundreds of experiences have shown me that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes, why do I take that one drink? Why can't I stay on the water wagon? What has become of a common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? So those are legitimate questions back then. We are so lucky today. We can get the answers to these things on Google, you know, I mean, to some degree, you know. We are very, very fortunate today. You can get the concept anyway. You know, I clearly remember the first time I heard the idea of this being a disease, a mental obsession, and that changed everything for me. That was such a gift. You know, I didn't do anything with it for a long time, but at least I knew and it made sense. I can't imagine having the drinking problem I had and not getting that information. I don't see any outcome other than some sort of death. Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why, once at a certain point is reached, little or nothing can be done for him. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from the drink, as he may do for months or years, I challenge that, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes alcohol, whatever, and that's one thing too in this book. Has anybody noticed? They always use the word whatever. I'm not an English major, but shouldn't it be whatsoever? But maybe back then. Because when I read it, I'm always going, whatsoever, whatsoever. And guys are like, David says, whatever, whatever, whatever. When he takes alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this, and that's a big question when you're meeting a new guy. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, and this is important, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And Joe and Charlie say, you know, as they always point out, we are always stone cold sober when we take that first drink. And they explain it better than that, but anyway. If you ask him why he started on the last bender, chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. And you hear that in the detox, if you get to sit in detoxes, and we go around the room and ask people, what's your drug of choice, what's your name, what's your drug of choice, and tell us your experience with recovery. And you hear, I'm Dave, I'm an alcoholic, I've been in 5 detoxes, 3 rehabs, I had 9 months, and I got a flat tire, and it made me drink, you know. You hear things, and they truly believe, I'm trying to be mild, but they believe with all their heart that's truly what happened, and you try to explain it's not, and it doesn't always work. Sometimes these excuses have certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. You're lucky I'm not Barefoot Bill. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself in the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he'll laugh it off, but I think he will become irritated. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. And I think we can all understand that. We know we can't drink, but we always take that first drink. Mm-hmm. Some drinkers have excuses which they are satisfied part of the time. But in their hearts of hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once the malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. And today we're not, you know. Sorry to keep harping on that, but we know what's going on, not just here, just in society. You know, society's pretty well, fairly well informed. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect they're down for the count. A good question to ask yourself, where you can tell where you are in recovery, is every year you hear that the geniuses at MIT or some other fancy place have come up with a solution for the alcoholic craving, a pill that you can take that will allow you to drink like other people. And I think an important question is, if that were ever actually true, would you want to take it? You know, that's I don't. I think the life I've been given, I really don't think I would want to. So anyway, I'm down for the count. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal. But everyone hopefully awaits for the day where the sufferer will arouse himself from the lethargy and assert his power of will, or will grow up, or will mature, or will all the things my parents thought I needed to do. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, that day will not, may not, but probably will not arrive. He has lost control. And this is an interesting thing. It says, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to drink, to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. And, you know, that's an interesting topic for a meeting, because when you don't suspect it, you're still having fun. You know, it's still working. But all of a sudden, you're like, this isn't working. And you are way past that line. You know, we think it's working for a long time. Or we think we can change, or something's going to change. You know, we really, rationalization, that's what my sponsor used to say, just about every other sentence that came out of my mouth, he'd say, I hear our ancient enemy, rationalization, again. But rationalization is really an issue for people like, well, for me anyway. But yeah, the tragic situation has arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, and this is in italics, most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into the consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Mm-hmm. And another great topic is, you know, the things that happened to us, the things we did, swearing we'd never drink again, and I mean, you know, it's not in good taste to even go into it. You know, the things that we, I mean, that I did, and you know. And saying, my God, how did I get here? And then a week later, doing it again, you know. So anyway, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If the thoughts occur, and these are just great descriptions again for the guy reading this book by himself. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. And, you know, you can relate to that if you're, yeah, it's one of the thoughts we have. there's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from, say, putting his hand on a hot stove. And that's when I read this book by myself, I thought that was a stupid analogy, but that's a great analogy if you have ever put your hand. I didn't put my hand on a hot stove, but I remember when I was little, we were at my grandmother's house, and we were playing like hide the quarter, you know, or something, but my sisters were just so freaking bored. So I'm looking for the quarter, and there's like this light sconce thing with no light bulb in it, so I thought maybe my sister had put it in there, so I stuck my finger in there, and I never did that again. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it will not electrocute me this time, or perhaps he doesn't think at all, and I think that's true. We don't think at all. You know, having this stuff pointed out to you for the first time is a little hard to swallow, but true. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sake, how did I ever get started again, only to have the thought supplanted by, well, I'll stop after the sixth drink, or what's the use anyway? When this sort of thinking is fully established in the individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. And that's an interesting, we understand that, but when you first read this book, that would be a little curious. Unless he's locked up, may die or go permanently insane. And that is what happened to us before AA, you know. We were locked up or we went insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. And again, if you read the book that I'm slowly reading, Slaying the Dragon, it's fascinating on what happened to us throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. And finally, here we are. And they're talking about before AA, thousands, millions of demonstrations. They want to stop but they cannot. There is a solution. You know, almost none of us, I would say all of us, do not like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which this process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness, the futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to do but pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed. And that's a pretty heavy statement, the fourth dimension of existence. I understand it now, but when you first read it, it's a little, it's big, I'll leave it at that.
It's big.
The great fact is this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. And this is to me, spiritual experience has always been, and I don't have a better idea, but it's always been a little hokey. You know, what is spiritual? But that is what it is. And if you go, and you should always go back to the back of the book here, and I'm just going to read the first thing on page 567. I think you should always take the newcomer back here, because it says they have a thing on the spiritual experience. It says the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that, and this is what we're looking for here, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. And then they go on to talk a little bit about people were confused. They thought we all had to be like Bill Wilson and see a white light and see God immediately. And that's just generally not how it happens. And that's not how it happened for me. And then at the end of this, it says, most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated with an attitude of intolerance and belligerent denial. It's like I said, it's always better when a guy says, I'm not going for this God thing, because at least you know where you're going with them. It says, we find that no one need to have difficulty with spirituality of this program, but it says, willingness, honesty, these are real tough ones, at least for me, willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery. I guess that's why it took me so long. But these are indispensable. And this is good. It just says, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep Dave in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And that applies to a lot of areas in life. The spiritual, we just see things differently. Our priorities change. We go from being takers to givers. We care more about you than we do about us. I care more about how everyone else is doing than I do myself. And that sounds impossible, especially for me, but it's when it starts to happen, it's so wonderful, and you're so... It's just so much better. I wish we could give you a shot of it. I wish someone could have given me a shot of it for an hour when I first got here, and I would have worked a lot harder. Which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward, like I said, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. And that is true. You know, when I first got here, I was like, come on. But that is what happens to us. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. That's true. If you're seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution, and that is 100% true. I've been looking for that middle of the road solution for a long time, and I've met a lot of you out there. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. I like this one. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. The other was to accept spiritual help. And I used to work on a trading desk, and a guy said, I think we're talking about the bitter end. And he said, oh, yeah, how do you get to the bitter end? And he goes, well, you go all the way down to the end of Wits End. You make a left, go all the way down, that gets you to the bitter end. Blotting out the consciousness of to accept. And alcoholics have a hard time with, we have a hard time with that. You really need to, as a sponsor, talk about what spiritual help is. You need to, I needed my sponsor, that's why he was so good. He explained things to me in a way I could understand. Boom. Okay. Man, I must be a really slow reader, huh? So I think we are going to stop there, and we will pick up. Actually, you know what? I'm going to go just one more thing. This is important. So it says this we did because we honestly wanted to, and we were willing to make the effort. A certain American businessman of good. Floundered, said, this is Roland Hazard. This is important. You know what? I'm going to save this for next week. This is okay. Knowing myself, we'll be here till 8:30. So with that, I'm done. Thank you.